Well, let's go ahead and get started. We're going to look, if you remember, last week we got all the way to chapter 4. And last week, we did not finish chapter 4. So we've got to start last week's handout on page 7. We're going to look at chapter 4. Again, we're going to try to get all the way to chapter 8. I think we'll be able to do that. Let's look at Deuteronomy chapter 4. There are some copies on the table out back of last week's handout. If you did not happen to bring that with you, or you weren't here last week, those copies are available back there. Deuteronomy, up to this point, we've seen how that Moses was looking at God's grace given to the Exodus generation, and how that grace was provided in a way in which they would experience God's blessings, but also how that they rebelled against God's provision. Then we looked in chapter 2 through chapter 3 at God's provision of grace to a new or the next generation. This is after 40 years in the wilderness, and Moses began on the plains of Moab to talk to the new generation. Now we're going to look at the future generation. And beginning in chapter 4, verse 1, we see a common theme that begins in chapter 4. It's something that will be rehearsed over and over and over again throughout the book of Deuteronomy. And that is simply this: obey, blessings, disobey, you could put bad stuff, you could put terrible things, you could put trauma. In its most painful form, destruction. And as we look at Deuteronomy, we see this theme repeated over and over and over again. It will come up again in chapter 6. It will come up. Chapter 7 is devoted to the blessings of obedience. Chapter 8 is talking again about the curse that happens when we disobey. And so in chapter 4, we see this theme running throughout the book of Deuteronomy, and kind of sets an outline that will be rehearsed again and again and again. It begins with Moses making an appeal. In chapter 4, verse 1, "Now, O Israel, listen to the statutes and judgments which I teach you to observe, that you may live and go in and possess the land which the Lord God of your fathers is giving you. You shall not add to the word which I command you, nor take from it, that you may keep the commandments of the Lord your God, which I command you. Your eyes have seen what the Lord did at Baal Peor, for the Lord your God has destroyed from among you all the men who followed Baal of Peor. But you who held fast to the Lord your God are alive today, every one of you. Surely I have taught you statutes and judgments, just as the Lord my God commanded me, that you should act according to them in the land which you go to possess. Therefore be careful to observe them, for this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the peoples who will hear all these statutes and say, 'Surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. For what great nation is there that has God so near to it as the Lord your God is to us, for whatever reason we may call upon him? And what great nation is there that has such statutes and righteous judgments as are in all this law which I set before you this day? Only take heed to yourselves, and diligently keep yourself, lest you forget the things your eyes have seen, and lest you depart from your heart all the days of your life, and teach them to your children and your grandchildren, especially concerning the day you stood before the Lord your God in Horeb, when the Lord God said to me, gather the people to me, and I will let them hear my words, that they may learn to fear me all the days they live on the earth, and that they may teach their children. Then you came near and stood at the foot of the mountain, and the mountain burned with fire to the midst of the heaven, with darkness, cloud, and thick darkness. And the Lord spoke to you out of the midst of the fire. You heard the sound of the words, but saw no form. You only heard a voice. So he declared to you his covenant, which he commanded you to perform, the Ten Commandments. And he wrote them on two tablets of stone. And the Lord commanded me at that time to teach you statutes and judgments, that you might observe them in the land which you cross over to possess. All right, so in verses 1 through 14, what Moses does is he reminds them that there is a path that they are to follow when they go in to possess the land. And that path runs along the track of the statutes and the judgments that God had given them. And those statutes and judgments are the Ten Commandments, but they're also everything that Moses is about to tell them that we haven't gotten to yet. Those statutes and judgments comprise the words of God. And those words of God highlight the will of God for his people. And Moses says over and over and over again, take heed, be careful, so that you obey these statutes and judgments, so that you walk in the way of these statutes and judgments, so that you do what God has told you to do. All those words that Moses uses really comes down to this. God has shown you what to do, now obey him. There it is. Now, we can dig down deep, as deeply as we want to go, into the different words and forms and aspects of this passage. That's what the end notes are for. But when it comes down to it, it's simply summarized by this. God has shown you what to do. Now do it. Verse 15. How was that? That was pretty good. That was quick. Verse 15. Take careful heed to yourselves, for you saw no form when the Lord spoke to you at Horeb. Oh, I forgot to say, remember what Horeb, H-O-R-E-B, that is synonymous for what? Mount Sinai, the giving of the Ten Commandments. Okay? So every time you see Moses referring to Horeb, he's talking about the giving of the Ten Commandments. In verses 10, 11, and 12, he is taking a backward glance at when God spoke and gave the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments. And now he's speaking to a generation who were at best just children during that time, and some who weren't even there. All right, so verse 14, take careful heed to yourselves, for you saw no form when the Lord spoke to you at Horeb out of the midst of the fire, lest you act corruptly and make for yourselves a carved image in the form of any figure, the likeness of male or female, the likeness of any animal that is on the earth, likeness of any winged bird that flies in the air, the likeness of anything that creeps on the ground. Verse 19, take heed lest you with your eyes to heaven, and when you lift your eyes to heaven, and when you see the sun, the moon, the stars, all the hosts of heaven, you feel driven to worship them and serve them, which the Lord your God has given to all the peoples under the whole heaven as a heritage. But the Lord has taken you and brought you out of the iron furnace, out of Egypt, to be his people, an inheritance as you are this day. Furthermore, the Lord was angry with me for your sakes. Another very important statement. He was angry with me for your sakes, and swore that I would not cross over the Jordan, that I would not enter the good land which the Lord God is giving you as an inheritance, but I must die in this land. I must not cross over the Jordan, but you shall cross over and possess the good land. Take heed to yourselves, lest you forget the covenant of the Lord your God, which he made with you, and make for yourselves a carved image in the form of anything which the Lord your God has forbidden you. For the Lord your God is a consuming fire and a jealous God. All right, let's stop there. Again, here's what he's saying. Here is one of the avenues that's going to be dangerous for the children of Israel as they walk into the promised land. We'll look at that again when we look at the Ten Commandments. It is, you shall have no carved image before me. Now Moses is saying, all right, when you go into the promised land, there are going to be people who are worshiping the sun, moon, and stars. There are going to be people who are worshiping carved image, idols. And there is going to be temptation for you to adopt their forms of worship. And you're going to perhaps, we'll see this especially in the Decalogue, you're going to perhaps play the game of, well, I'm just carving out this image, and I know it's like the other images that other pagan or people who don't know God, they worship these idols, they call them Baal or whatever, and I know that they're worshiping this idol, but I'm just carving this image to give me a visual form of who God is, the one true God. And Moses is saying, don't do that, because that's going to be idolatry. You're worshiping something made with your hands rather than the God who made all things. So he says, beware of any form of idolatry. He hints when he brings up his own inability to go to the promised land, he brings up and hints in the context, he's pointing to the idolatry that would happen if the children of Israel don't take heed, if they don't watch, if they aren't careful, they could practice idolatry. And then he inserts, and God's not going to let me go into the promised land. He doesn't give any more explanation in the context other than saying, because he was angry with me for your sakes. And in the context, most believe that part of the anger of God toward the children of Israel, and Moses is there, it's that they did worship idols on their journey through the wilderness. They had a moment, at least one that we have recorded, not only at the base of Mount Sinai, but at Baal Peor, where they worshiped idols. And it's in that context that God says, I'm angry. Moses says that God was angry with me on your account. So again, God takes very seriously this, you shall have no carved image before me. Idolatry is not something that he winks at, whether it's back then or whether it's today. All right? So he says, now, you got to be careful of idolatry. Beginning of verse 25, he says, when you beget children and grandchildren have grown old in the land and act corruptly, and make a carved image in the form of anything, and do evil in the sight of the Lord your God to provoke him to anger, I call heaven and earth to witness against you this day that you will soon utterly perish from the land which you cross over the Jordan to possess. You will not prolong your days in it, but will be utterly destroyed. And the Lord will scatter you among the peoples, and you will be left few in number among the nations where the Lord will drive you. And there you will serve gods and the work of men's hands, wood and stone, which neither see nor hear nor eat nor smell. But from there you will seek the Lord your God, and you will find him if you seek him with all your heart and with all your soul. When you are in distress and in all these things come upon you in the latter days, when you turn to the voice of the Lord and obey his voice, for the Lord your God, verse 31, for the Lord your God is a merciful God. He will not forsake you, nor destroy you, nor forget the covenant of your fathers, which he swore to them. For ask now concerning the days that are past, which were before you since the day that God created man on earth, and ask from the one end of heaven to the other, whether any great thing like this has happened or anything like it has been heard. Did any people ever hear the voice of God speaking out of the midst of the fire as you have heard and live? Or did God ever try to go out and take for himself a nation by trials, by signs, by wonders, by war, by a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, and by great terrors, according to all that the Lord your God did for you in Egypt before your eyes? To you it was shown, that you might know that the Lord himself is God. There is none other besides him. Out of heaven he let you hear his voice, that he might instruct you. On earth he showed you his great fire, and you heard his words out of the midst of the fire. And because he loved your fathers, therefore he chose their descendants after them. And he brought you out of Egypt with his presence and with his mighty power, driving out from before you nations greater and mightier than you, to bring you in, to give you their land as an inheritance, as it is this day. Therefore, know this day and consider it in your heart, that the Lord himself is God in heaven above and on the earth beneath. There is no other. You shall therefore keep his statutes and commandments, which I command you today, that it may go well with you and with your children after you, that you may prolong your days in the land which the Lord your God is giving you for all time. All right, so here's what he says. If you disobey, you will perish. But if you obey, then you will flourish. Now, when he says you will disobey, if you disobey, you will perish, he's saying if you go into the promised land and you forget him, we're going to come back to this theme in chapter 8. If you go into the promised land, you forget him, and you fail to obey his commandments, then you will be utterly destroyed. In verse 26 or verse 27, he says, I will scatter you from among the peoples, and you'll be left few in number. He's saying there's going to be a remnant. All right, so you are going to perish. They disobey. God scatters. There's a remnant. They will seek. God will be found. God will bless again. All right, this is also one of those themes that runs throughout Deuteronomy. It's not all in chapter 4, although verses 26, 27, 28 kind of starts the engines on it, but I don't want this to get lost. Here's kind of a pattern. And it's a pattern not only for Israel, it's a pattern for us as well. All right? So when we disobey, then we will face the discipline. God scatters. And what he says specifically to the children of Israel, if you disobey me, then I'm going to scatter you from the land. You're not going to possess it any longer. And you're going to be taken to foreign lands. We know that happened for both Israel and for Judah. There was an exile that happened. We're looking at Micah on the weekends, on Sundays, and we see that in the time that Micah was preaching before and then after, there were those seasons of scattering where God took the children of Israel and scattered them and sent them into exile into foreign lands. So when we disobey, then God will scatter. But there will be a remnant that remains. There will be a few in number that remain. Now, they don't remain necessarily in the land. In chapter 8, we see that they remain in those foreign lands. Chapter 7, I think, somewhere in there. Anyway, we'll get to it. But there's a remnant. And that remnant is primarily pictured in a foreign land where idolatry is practiced, where people are pursuing other gods. But the children of Israel, the remnant that is in that foreign land, they will become hungry, not for the idols that the people around them are worshiping, but they will become hungry for the one true God whom they have known in the memory of their heritage. And they will seek God. And when they seek God, God will be found by them. And when they find God, then God will bless them again. This is a great pattern for us to remember when we are disobedient. Beautiful picture for us to remember when we are disobedient. We disobey, then God's going to scatter us. As followers of Christ, we will be disciplined. Discipline's an easier word than punished or judged, but all those things are true about what God does for us. When we forget Him, when we fail to obey His commandments, we will experience His discipline. But as we, as followers of Christ, are in that discipline season, if we seek God, then He will be found by us when we seek Him with our whole heart. When we seek Him with our whole heart, then He will be found and He will bless us again. So as we look at this pattern that continues, it leads us here. The final part of that process leads us back over here. You see? Can you see that? The final part of this journey of perishing leads us back to the blessing so that we're back on this side of obedience again. And it's in that season that we find that God is merciful and God is faithful. Two great themes about God, or three great themes about God, that come through in chapters 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8 is that first, God is holy. Second, God is merciful. And third, God is faithful. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. I don't know where I am on my notes, but that's good. That means I'm just talking. Here we go. Let's go on to this week's note sheet. Yes, sir. Right. 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 Yeah, they never got to go to the promised land. So the land is very important in the covenant that God has established. There are three aspects of the covenant that God established with Israel: God, the people, and the land. And if the people disobey God, then they forfeit the land. The same is true here. In this context, they've been scattered; they forfeit the land. Wherever we see, but that's not the same as salvation. Promised land does not equal salvation. That's a different animal altogether. We might sing metaphorically about the promised land or Beulah land as if that's salvation. The promised land was actually, the Hebrew term is Eretz. It's the earth. It's dirt. It's not heaven. For Israel, it was the place flowing with milk and honey, but that's a picture of its agricultural prowess and productivity. The promised land is not synonymous with heaven. The promised land is not synonymous with salvation. The promised land is synonymous with the full measure of God's blessings for His people on this earth. Okay? So that's a great point. So for the wilderness generation, they had pushed God to the limit where His patience finally ended, and He said, now is judgment. And the judgment for the wilderness generation is they don't get to go to the promised land. They forfeit the land flowing with milk and honey. And they spend their days in the wilderness. But as we'll see in chapter 7 or chapter 8, the wilderness was not only a place of discipline for the wilderness generation, but the wilderness was also a place of testing and education for God's people. And it was a place of growth for them, a place where they would see again God's faithfulness. They would learn again God's faithfulness. And they would also reveal their heart to the Father. Let's move on to chapter 4, verse 41 through the end of the book there, 41 through 43, we see that Moses establishes, when you go into the land, have these cities of refuge. We'll talk more about them later. We're not going to spend any time on that. Verses 44 through 49, he begins to introduce the retelling of the Ten Commandments. Verse 44, now this is the law which Moses set before the children of Israel. Verse 45, these are the testimonies, the statutes, and the judgments which Moses spoke to the children of Israel after they came out of Egypt. Now, again, here's what you need to understand. When you see these terms, testimonies, statutes, judgments, all ordinances would be another one. Promises would be another one. All of these words are words in the Old Testament describing God's will, describing God's truth, describing not just the Ten Commandments, but the very words of God. You go to Psalm 119, you spend any time in Psalm 119, you're going to get a whole dose of ordinances, judgments, statutes, testimonies, and promises. And all of those are pictures of God's will. Now, as Moses uses statutes and judgments, he's not just talking about the Ten Commandments he's about to recite. But the testimonies, statutes, and judgments are the Ten Commandments that he's about to review, as well as the other things that he's about to give all the way to chapter 26. It includes that whole giving of the law and the explanation of the law and the application of the law. So we're going to take this journey with the children of Israel as they prepare to enter the land of promise, and we're going to hear all that God had to say to them so that we might apply it to our life today, and so that we might obey the Lord and be blessed. And if we are in disobedience to the Lord, that we would seek God so that he might be found, so that he might bless us again. This pattern is an Old Testament pattern. It's a pattern for revival of God's people. There's a passage that we quote anytime we're talking about revivals, at least we used to when we do tent revivals or lay evangelism or lay revivals or anything like that. There's a passage that talks about revival. What do y'all think I'm thinking of? It's not in Deuteronomy. It was to Solomon at the dedication of the temple. 2 Chronicles 7:14. If my people who are called by my name shall humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will heal their land. I will hear their prayer. I will heal their land. That's the picture of revival. We see it here in Deuteronomy. We see it throughout the Scripture, in Ezekiel. We'll see it in Micah. We'll see it in Jeremiah. All of these passages paint the picture of God. Although we've been disobedient, and although we're experiencing the consequences of our disobedience, God gives us an opportunity for hope. Today, regardless of your disobedience, God's given you an opportunity for hope. Because God is a merciful God, verse 31. Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 31. For God is a merciful God. All right? Now, as we're looking in chapter 4, we see in verses 29 through 31, there's the hope. There's hope for the remnant because God is merciful. That's 31. Following the establishment of the cities of refuge, 41 through 43, Moses begins to explain the Ten Commandments for the new generation. Moses introduces the law with three specific words, testimonies, statutes, and rules. I'm on page 2 of tonight's sheet. I'm on paragraph 1, 2, 3, 4. Moses gathered all the children of Israel to himself. He called them to hear the statutes and the judgments of the law, to learn them and to obey them. Look at chapter 5, verse 1. Now, let me just read through the Ten Commandments, and that's all the way to verse 22, the beginning, the prologue and the postlogue of the Ten Commandments. All right, so 5, 1 through 22. Moses called all Israel and said to them, "Hear, O Israel." Y'all know, "Hear, O Israel." Hear, do y'all know what that Hebrew term is? It comes up several times. It is called, I'll use a different color. It is called Shema. That's the verb, hear. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Therefore you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength. That's the Shema. And it's Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 4. So he begins with this mandate, hear, O Israel. The statutes and judgments which I speak in your hearing today, that you may learn and be careful to observe them. The Lord your God made a covenant with us in Horeb. What does Horeb point to? Mount Sinai, the giving of the Ten Commandments. The Lord did not make this covenant with our fathers, but with us, those who are here today, all of us who are alive. That's an interesting thing that Moses does right there in verse 3. He says, the Lord did not make this covenant with our fathers, but with us. Now, as you read that, New King James Version, it seems like, well, God didn't make a covenant with their fathers, with this previous generation, the wilderness generation, the Exodus generation. It seems that's what the Hebrew is saying, but it's not really saying that. What it's saying is, not only with them, but with us. The covenant is active and applicable, past, present, and future. The covenant is active for all the people who are under the covenant of God today. And by the way, if you're a follower of Jesus, you're under that covenant today. So we are here today listening to these words, and they apply to us today. Now, Edie told me, and Edie's here tonight, but Edie told me that I would be able to get through all of these verses if I wouldn't say, quote, "by the way," and then chase a rabbit. That's what she told me this morning. She said, "Eric, you'll get through it if you don't do by the way, dot, dot, dot." But I'm about to do a by the way. By the way. When we look to Matthew's gospel and we see that Jesus is the fulfillment of the law, that is absolutely true. But when we look at that term fulfillment in the New Testament, we're looking at he completes it. He perfects it. More importantly, he is the one who fulfills it himself. He does the law perfectly. What many believers have done is they've said, well, if Jesus is the fulfillment of the law, then the law no longer applies. But that's wrong. That's wrong theology. The law does apply. It just applies to us through the person of Jesus Christ. So it doesn't have different force, it has different expression for us today. The most important relationship that we have is with God through faith in Jesus Christ. We do not today, nor did they back then, earn relationship with God by completing the law. That's not what gained them the relationship. We're going to see this if I get to it. We're going to see that the reason Israel had relationship with God was because God chose them. And he called them his treasured possessions. God called them to be his own. And we're going to see that God chose them to be his, not based upon any inherent quality that they possessed, but only because he loved them. They did not earn their spot in heaven. They did not earn their status as God's treasured possession. They received that by grace, even in Deuteronomy. Gretchen, do you have a question?
Yeah, well, they had a relationship first with God, and then came the law. Just like we as parents don't give rules to other kids that aren't ours.
Right, that's what I mean. God chose them, and then he said, "Now, obey." God chose them, and then he said, "Now, obey." All right? And for those of you who are worried about the chosen language, that's Bible. You can't escape chosen. That's Bible, okay? And that's New Testament and Old Testament. But let me say this. There were children of Israel that chose not to obey. So, once again, you ask me, am I a Calvinist? Well, that first statement was very Calvinist. That second statement was very not Calvinist. So, again, skirting the line. All right. Here we go. So, we look at this passage, and we see that Moses was calling the people together. Verse 4, the Lord talked with you face to face on the mountain from the midst of the fire. I stood between the Lord and you at that time to declare to you the word of the Lord, for you were afraid because of the fire, and you didn't go up to the mountain. And here's what he said. I'm the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, and out of the house of bondage. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself any carved image, any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water underneath the earth. You shall not bow down to them, nor serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generations of those who hate me. Verse 10, but showing mercy. That term mercy is hesed. That's the covenant love of God. Showing covenant, steadfast love. Your translation, New American Standard, maybe ESV. I don't know what the NIV does, but your translation may say steadfast love. Showing mercy to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments. Do you see the pattern there again? If you bow down to other idols, I'm gonna punish you. But if you love me, then I'm going to bless you. Verse 11. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Verse 12. Observe the Sabbath day to keep it holy as the Lord your God commanded you. 6 days you shall labor, do all your work. Seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall do no work, etc., 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 etc. Verse 15. And remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out from there by a mighty hand, by an outstretched arm. Therefore, the Lord your God commanded you to keep the Sabbath day. 16, honor your father and mother, as the Lord your God has commanded you, that your days may be long, that it may be well with you in the land which the Lord your God is giving you. Don't murder, don't commit adultery, don't steal, don't bear false witness against your neighbor, don't covet your neighbor's wife, nor desire your neighbor's house, his field, his male servant, his female servant, his ox, his donkey, or anything that is your neighbor's. These words the Lord spoke to you, spoke to all your assembly in the mountain from the midst of the fire, the cloud, thick darkness, with a loud voice, and he added no more. And he wrote them on two tablets of stone and gave them to me. So Moses is here on the plains of Moab. He's retelling the law. He's retelling it because where are the tablets of stone? They're in the Ark of the Covenant. He didn't pull them out of the Ark of the Covenant. He's retelling them. He's retelling them probably the way he has retold them year after year after year after year. He's retelling them. Not only is he retelling them, he's preaching them. See, if you go to Exodus 20 and you look at the Ten Commandments, you see Deuteronomy here in chapter 5, you see that there's some differences there. There's some expansions here. Well, why? Because he's preaching it. And you know preachers. No, he's applying it as he goes. He's reviewing it. He's applying it. He's expanding it. He's not adding to what the Lord said. He is the prophet of the Lord in this moment. Remember, Moses was a prophet. And God was speaking through him at that moment. So he was giving application and explanation as he's reviewing the Ten Commandments. Moses reviewing the law helps us understand again, and I will go through these. Number one, we're doing the Ten Commandments. Exclusive loyalty to God. You shall have no other gods before me. Verse two, commandment number two, you will have no idols before me. That's visual substitutes. That's not just a little Buddha in your home. It's any substitute that you have for God. You shall have no other idols before me. Number three, don't misuse God's name. That's verse 11. Misusing God's name is not merely using the swear word. And if I were to write it up there, y'all would get mad. And I would too if I saw it up there. But that swear word, God, do something, that is a picture of misusing God's name. It's not just a swear word. It's not just a curse word. You're asking God to do something, to judge, to literally condemn to the pit of hell something. And this commandment says, do not do that. You should never use God's name in a manner that seeks to manipulate God to work for your personal interests. Don't misuse God's name. Some of our prayers violate the third commandment. Just something to think about. All right. Number four, keep the Sabbath. This is verses 12 through 15. Keep the Sabbath, and for it is holy unto the Lord. Keep it, make it holy unto the Lord. Now, some denominations make great hay about how we're not keeping the Sabbath because we count the Sabbath on Sunday, and the real Sabbath is on Saturday. Now, they are correct. The real Sabbath is on Saturday. That is the Sabbath of the Old Testament. But that's legalistic as well. The Sabbath is to set it apart as holy unto the Lord. That means that you're taking one day a week and you're saying this day is devoted and dedicated to focusing on God, remembering His rescuing love. In fact, that's one of the things, I think in verse 12, he says, remember that it's the Lord who has rescued you. It's the Lord your God that brought you up out of Egypt. It's the Lord your God who, with an outstretched arm and a mighty hand, has redeemed you. In Exodus, it's all about creation, 6 days and then rest. That's included here. But then Deuteronomy, Moses adds this part. Not only is it a picture of creation to take the seventh day and rest, but more importantly, it is the rescuing love of God that you're celebrating. It's how He brought you into relationship with yourself. So that's one of the reasons why we as a people celebrate the Sabbath corporately at First Baptist Church Norfolk on Sunday, because that very day is a reminder of God's rescuing love. It is the day of Christ's resurrection, victory over death, hell, and the grave. So the day itself is not as important as the principle behind it. The principle behind it is you need to take 24 hours and you need to celebrate what God has done in your life. You need to do that every week. I read a statistic this morning on the way to work during my commute. I read this statistic. Look, I didn't want to break the commitment of bearing false witness, so I thought I'd tell the truth. But I was reading a statistic that said in 2015, one of the most disturbing trends in 2015 is that people who are members of church will attend church less than they did in 2014. These are faithful members. So if you have a church member that attends 4 out of 4 Sundays a month, the trend is in 2015, they'll do 3 out of 4, or 4 out of 5, or 6 out of 8, or 1 out of 4. Now, I don't know where, he had all these things, places where he got the statistics, but if it is true, that is disturbing. That is extremely disturbing. When Edie and I were in Mississippi and pastoring at First Baptist Vicksburg, we would have people who were fanatic turkey hunters. And turkey hunters are more fanatic than fly fishermen. They're scary, scary, scary freak. They really are. They're fanatics. They have all kinds of crazy things that they think about. Anyway, there were turkey hunters and deer hunters and duck hunters, hunters of all kinds. And some of them, the beginning of hunting season would be the last time you see them in church until the end of hunting season. And invariably, they would come up with that same old rigmarole that they would say, I can worship God as much in a deer stand as I do out in the church. And my response was always the same. That may be true, but do you? You see, we get in church and we have a hard time worshiping. And we've set aside this building as holy unto the Lord on Sunday mornings. It's challenging. It's challenging. And we need that. I think one of the reasons why we have Hebrews 10, it says, don't forsake the assembling of yourselves together, as is the custom of some, but get together to encourage one another and stir up love and good works in one another. I think the reason that's there is because not only is it a reflection back on this commandment, but it is also important for us. We need each other to help each other set aside the Sabbath as holy unto the Lord. All right, and to remember why. You see, we need to remember why we're here. It's not only to rest. We can rest anywhere, but it is that aspect of celebrating God's rescuing love. All right? So, keep the Sabbath holy unto the Lord. Commandment number 5, respect your parents. That's verse 16. By the way, this commandment was given to adults. When we look at the household codes in Colossians 3 and Ephesians 6, we tend to think, I always have, that children honor your parents. You know, I mean, that was given to me when I was in sixth grade. You know, honor your parents. And that's good, and that's right. But the commandment here was not given to children. It was given to adults to honor their parents. The commandment is to honor your aging parents. So as I look at this commandment that applies to me today, I need to honor my mom and dad. Show them the honor and respect that they deserve. It doesn't mean that it doesn't apply to children. It's just we can't give ourselves an out. In fact, it's part of the social structure, taking care of the aged. That was the nursing home of the day. You remember, perhaps you never forgot, but you need to remember that back then they didn't have Westminster or Canterbury. They had the home in which the whole family lived. Many times you have 3 and 4 generations living in the same home. And you are to show respect to your parents. All right? So, respect your parents. Don't murder. Don't commit adultery. Don't steal. Don't bear false witness against your neighbor. All of those are somewhat self-explanatory, and we have some people in here where I can't explain some of it. Commandment number 10, do not covet. Coveting has two aspects of it. The Hebrew term there, I've forgotten it. Whatever the Hebrew term is there, footnote 26, if you want to look. But whatever the Hebrew term is there, it means to have a desire, raham, I think. But anyway, it means to have a desire, but also it means to act upon that desire. So there's twofold aspects of coveting. It's not just don't have a desire for somebody's stuff, but it's also don't have a desire and then try to get somebody else's stuff. Whatever that is, whatever that looks like. Now, as you look at the commandments, what you begin to see is they all intertwine together. There is a theme that runs through. Commandments 1 through 4 deal primarily with relationship with God. Commandments 5 through 10 deal primarily with relationships within community. But all of them kind of feed each other. If I'm going to refrain from coveting, then I'm also going to refrain from stealing. By the way, do not steal. Just to give you a heads up, the Hebrew term there is used in the same way that we would use human trafficking today. It is certainly to take somebody's pen. If it, you know, it's not your pen, you go take it, right? That's one aspect of it, but it also has a broader connotation of kidnapping somebody for your own ends. All right? So those are the Ten Commandments. In verses 22 through 31, he gives the history of the giving of the law and the response of the Exodus generation. Now, in chapter 6, verse 1, Moses begins the greatest commandment, the Shema. Okay? In 6:1, he says, "Now this is the commandment, and these are the statutes and judgments which the Lord your God has commanded to teach you, that you may observe them in the land which you're crossing over." Do you hear that language over and over and over again? These are the commandments. These are the statutes. These are the judgments which the Lord your God has commanded to teach you, that you may observe them in the land which you are crossing over to possess, that you may fear the Lord your God. Okay, so part of this is fear God. Okay, that you may fear the Lord your God, to keep all his statutes, all his commandments, which I command you, and you and your son and your grandson, all the days of your life, that your days may be prolonged. So he's saying, if you fear the Lord, then it's going to lead to obey. The Hebrew term there is yara. That's the Hebrew term, to fear the Lord. Now, what is fear the Lord? Well, fear the Lord is to be scared of God. I don't want to diminish that at all. We're going to see how that God is a great and a fearful God. And when he's on your side fighting the battle for you, you don't have to worry about it. But he is also a great and fearful God. And if we are disobeying him, we need to be afraid. See, we have domesticated God so much and made him such a Santa Claus and a grandfather that we forget that he is a holy God and he is a fearful God, and we should fear him. All right, so we need to fear the Lord. To fear the Lord is to be scared of God, not in an unhealthy way, but in a healthy way. When I was a kid, I knew that my dad, if I did wrong, that I would get punished, and I was afraid of that punishment. I never doubted his love, but I was fearful of the discipline because I knew that my dad was scary. Anyway, there are standards, and God said, you got to follow these standards. If you don't follow them, then there's going to be judgment. Now, his judgment is always tempered by his love and his mercy, and I love that about God, but I can't count on that all the time. All right, so we need to fear him. That means that we need to be scared of him. But it also, more importantly and probably more fully, it means we need to fear him. We need to reverence him. We need to honor him. We need to recognize that he is God. We're not. Okay? So fear is scared, but it's more importantly reverence. And when we fear him, we will obey him. It goes on. Verse 3, "Therefore hear, O Israel, and be careful to observe it, that it may be well with you, and that you may multiply greatly as the Lord God of your fathers promised you." And again, so he says, fear the Lord, obey the Lord, and God will bless. See the pattern there? Verse 3. All right, so verse 2 and 3, fear the Lord, keep his commandments. Verse 3, hear, O Israel, observe it, may be well with you, that you may multiply greatly as the Lord your God has promised you, a land flowing with milk and honey. Now verse 4 is the Shema proper. Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength. And these words which I command you today shall be in your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children. Talk of them when you sit in the house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, when you rise up. Bind them as a sign on your hand, They shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house. So then he says, not just fear the Lord, but love. To love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Or love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and strength. He's saying, love the Lord with all that you are, and that's what's going to lead to obey. But as we obey, he adds another ingredient. He says, not just obey, but teach. Not just obey it, but teach it. So not only are we to obey what God says, but we're supposed to pass it on to our children and to our grandchildren. And not just teach it, but to be saturated with it. When Moses says, doorposts, and as you rise up, and as you lay down, and as you go, wherever you are, the word of the Lord, his testimonies, his statutes, his ordinances, his judgments, his will, his word, those words of God, his will, must saturate our lives. And when we love the Lord, our God, with all that we are, we will obey and we will teach, but it's more than just obeying a list of regulations. Take, for example, driving during your commute with a smartphone. It is illegal to read an article on your smartphone when you're driving. That is a rule. That is a regulation. But I am not in love with the Virginia Department of Transportation, nor am I in love with, you know what I mean. It's a law, and I will obey it because of different reasons. I don't want to get a ticket or something like that, click it or ticket. You know, I don't want a ticket, so I may obey it. But if I think I can get away with it and not get caught, maybe I'll do it. But that's different when you're in relationships. See, when it saturates our lives, it's more than just obeying and teaching rules that they must follow. It's not teaching geometry. It's not teaching German. It's teaching a lifestyle of relationship with God. So when we love God, we're loving Him with our whole self, so that our whole self is saturated with love for Him. And the law, the words, the statutes, the rules, those are not built on just regulations that we need to follow. Those are built on, I love God. And I want to please God. I want to honor Him. So when our lives are saturated, it's not just to be a good citizen in the land of promise, but it is to live in a dynamic, real relationship with God. Beginning in chapter 6, verse 10, again, we have this pattern. There is a caution that he gives us for disobedience. It will be when the Lord your God brings you into the land of which he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, to give you large and beautiful cities which you did not build, houses full of good things which you did not fill, hewn out wells which you did not dig, vineyards and olive trees which you did not plant. When you have eaten and are full, then beware, verse 12, key, then beware lest you forget the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage. Disobedience flourishes when we are full. See, what Moses is saying is there's going to be a dangerous time. You're going to get to the promised land and you're going to get all these things that he just described. And then he says, beware lest you forget the Lord your God who brought you up out of the land of bondage in Egypt. He said, here's the danger. You're living fat on the land. that you did not possess by your own strength or power. But you're living in the prosperity of the land. Beware lest you forget that you did not do that yourself, and you forget the Lord. We'll see this theme come up again, but it's an amnesia that takes place. We rise up in pride, that's later on, chapter 7. We rise up in pride and we begin to think, oh, I got here by myself. I'm going to talk about this, I'll save it till Sunday. But we rise up in pride, we think, what? We start getting this entitlement idea. What? This is my land. And I own it because it's mine. We forget that we didn't do anything for the land. God gave it to us. We don't even exist if God didn't, in His mercy, bring us out of bondage. But that amnesia can hit us. On page 4, footnote 32, is a quote from a guy named Brueggemann, who is a liberal. Doesn't believe what I would consider most of us believe about the Bible. He doesn't think Moses wrote Deuteronomy, and he doesn't think a lot of things, but he is a scholar. He has some good things to say, especially about words and theology, theological perspectives. And this is a block quote there at the bottom that from Brueggemann, and I think he gets it. I think he gets clearly what God is trying to communicate here. He says, Moses knows that satiation produces amnesia. And amnesia is the great threat to a community whose defining relationship is grounded in a concrete, nameable memory. Satiation banishes the past and obliterates the future. Everything is reduced to an endless present tense. All that matters is me right here, right now. Forget how I got here. Forget what's expected of me. All that matters is me right here, right now. All right, so verses 21 through 23 rehearses how God delivered them from the promised land and brought judgment on Egypt, and how God delivered them from bondage in Egypt, how He brought them to the promised land. Verses 24 and 25, He gave them His law. He presented to them the conditions for experiencing blessings of the covenant, which is, namely, obey Him and fear Him. In fact, look at verse 24 and 25 of chapter 6. The Lord commanded us to observe all these statutes, to fear the Lord our God for our good always, that He might preserve us alive as it is this day. Then it will be righteousness for us if we're careful to observe all these commandments before the Lord our God as He has commanded us. We're going to make it. All right, chapter 7. I'm not going to talk about eternal truths. You can look at that. Well, let me just say them. Some truths from chapter 4 and all the way to chapter 6. Be holy even as God is holy. God has requirements that He expects us to follow. Let's do it. His directions never go off course. God is sovereign, and when He gives us statutes and judgments and testimonies, they are right on target. His commands open our eyes to see life as it is, not the way we want it to be, not the way we think it is, not the way our friends say it is, but when God speaks, He's telling us the way things really are. Number 5, loving God supremely is our first purpose and sets the foundation for us being obedient in the other commands. All right, chapter 7, verses 1 through 25. Won't read all of it, don't have time, but I'll read a few verses here, beginning chapter 7, verse 1. When the Lord your God brings you into land which you go to possess, and He's cast out many nations before Him, the Hittites and all those people. Verse 2, when the Lord your God delivers them over to you, you shall conquer them and utterly destroy them. You shall make no covenant with them, nor show mercy to them. Nor shall you make marriages with them. You shall not give your daughter to their son, nor take your daughter their daughter for your son. For they will turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods, so the anger of the Lord will be aroused against you and destroy you suddenly. But thus you shall deal with them. You shall destroy their altars, break down their sacred pillars, cut down their wooden images, and burn their carved image images with fire. For you, all right, I'll stop right there. All right, so what's he saying? You go in and possess the land, destroy everybody. You want me to try to make that simpler? Kill everybody. I know that, boy, that just does not fly very well for us today. And I understand it. And I wish I could make it sound different. That's what he says. Yes?
I think my thought came that God wants to purify.
Yes, exactly. That's what he wants to do. He does not want any impurity. He doesn't want any threat to the holiness of the covenant community. Now, when I say you're supposed to destroy everybody, apparently in that whole idea, they're supposed to dispossess the people, push them out of the land so that those people are no longer in the land. That's at least part of it. Yeah.
Does that have any implications as today?
No. Zero. None whatsoever. Yeah. Because there's no... Israel in the promised land right now is national Israel, not covenant Israel. Israel in the Middle East is national Israel, like we're Americans. They're Israelites. Now, Jewish people are scattered throughout the world. Some of those Jewish people are followers of Jesus. Therefore, they are under the covenant of God's grace. But it has no implication today. I believe very strongly that God's not finished with Israel, and I believe with the people of Israel, not the nation of Israel. Any more than we talked about this last week. God is interested in people, not nations. All right. So I believe strongly in the people of Israel, the people that God has chosen for His special treasured possessions. But that is not that's not automatically equated to the nation. So do I have my personal preferences about what needs to happen in the Middle East? Absolutely, but that's built on my personal preferences. Yes.
One question is different. It's about the idols. That when you go shopping today, you get idols all over the place. And this stuff creeps into a lot of homes. And I guess what I'm asking is, as believers, I believe we should be doing house cleansings as far as what comes in that house and what shouldn't be in the house if we really work.
I agree with that. Let me, because I don't have much time, but I agree with that except for this. When you look at the Sermon on the Mount, which is Jesus' his exposition of the law, his main contention was with Pharisees who were following the letter of this law, and they had done their house cleansing. There weren't any idols in their life, in their house. But the real issue was not the little Buddha on the step. The real issue was the deadness in their own heart. They had idols in their own heart. In fact, Ezekiel talks about that very specifically in Ezekiel chapter 13 and 14. And he says, you need to turn and be turned, because anything that causes you to stumble into sin is an idol in your own making. I think that is more important, especially today, than anything that somebody might come around and say, well, that's an idol. I don't think that there's anything magical about a Buddha, anything magical. There is no totem that I think has power. I think that the most powerful idol we have is here.
So,
I'm sorry?
You don't believe in the mezuzah?
Mezuzah. I don't know what that is. So I apparently don't believe in it. Oh, you're talking about the Passover. Well, I believe in the Passover. But the Passover isn't taking... The idea that the death angel's coming again is contrary to Bible. So if that's practice of Jewish people today, then that's contrary to, you know, that's being afraid of the death angel today. That, I mean, they're not in Egypt. So... Y'all. All right. So God says there are chosen people. Verse 6, he says these words, verse 6 of chapter 7, "For you are a holy people to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you to be a people for himself, a special treasure above all the peoples on the face of the earth. The Lord did not set his love on you, nor choose you, because you were more in number than other people, or for you were the least of all the peoples. But because the Lord loves you, and because he would keep the oath which he swore to your fathers, the Lord has brought you out with a mighty hand and rescued you from the house of bondage, from the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Therefore, know that the Lord your God, he is God, the faithful God, who keeps his covenant and mercy for 1,000 generations with those who love him and keep his commandments. And he repays those who hate him to their face to destroy them. He will not be slack with him who hates him. He will repay him to his face. Therefore, you shall keep the commandments and the statutes and the judgments I command you to, today to observe." Chapter 7, verse 6 especially, he says, "You are a holy people." Holy there is the Hebrew term kadosh. And kadosh has the picture of set apart for God. That's the picture of kadosh. It is not automatically equated with morally pure. It is equated with set apart for something special by God. So when God says you are a holy people, he's not talking specifically about your moral purity or impurity. He's talking about God in love choosing you, setting you apart for himself. Okay? That's important. He set you apart as his treasured possession. And why did he choose you? Because he loved you. Not because you were great in number, not because there was anything significant about you. He chose you because he loved you. And then verses 12 through 26, the blessings of obedience. Chapter 8. Just want to hit some high points in chapter 8. He says, "You walked through the wilderness, and it was a time of testing. And in this time of testing, God showed his heart to you, but he also learned what your heart was for him. During this time of testing, God did everything for you. He gave you manna from heaven, and he made it even so your clothes would not wear out." That's verse 4. Verse 5 says that the wilderness was a time of discipline. But verse 6 says, "Keep the commandments, because the Lord your God is bringing you into land." And then he describes the blessings of the land. Now, verse 10, "When you have eaten and are full, then you shall bless the Lord your God for the good land which he has given you." Verse 11, "Beware that you do not forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments, his judgments, his statutes, which I command you, lest when you have eaten and are full," when you've done what verse 12 and 13 says, verse 14, 12 and 13 says, okay, so you have all this bounty that God has given you. Then verse 14, he says, "And then your heart is lifted up and you forget the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage, who led you through the great, terrible wilderness in which there were fiery serpents, scorpions, thirsty, where there was no water, who brought you water from out of a flinty rock, who fed you in the wilderness with manna, which your fathers did not know." Verse 17, "Then you say in your heart, my power and the might of my hand have gained me all this wealth." And he said, that's when you start disobeying. That's the disobedience, when in pride you forget God. When you forget God, you can be sure that that you are just about to enter into this pattern of scattering and hopefully remnant. God brings discipline upon those who forget him. Verse 19 and 20, "Then it shall be, if you by any means forget the Lord your God and follow other gods and serve them and worship them, I testify against you this day that you shall surely perish." As the nations which the Lord destroys before you, so you shall perish, because you would not be obedient to the voice of the Lord your God. Questions? Yes, sir. I didn't have time. What does verse 18 say? Oh, I didn't skip it because it was tricky. Chapter 8, verse 18. The Lord shall remember, and you shall remember the Lord your God, for it is He who gives you power to get wealth, that He may establish the covenant which He... that's not tricky. Remember the Lord your God. He's the one that gives you the power to get wealth, that He may establish His covenant, which He swore to your fathers as it is this day. He's just describing what he said people will experience in the promised land. They're going to experience all this bounty, and it's because God had given him to them. Other questions? Yes, sir. I'm sorry? Both. Yeah, that's why I said fear means to be scared of God as well as to reverence Him. It's both and. If you're not afraid of God, then you don't see God the way He really is. I mean, you got to fear Him. Be afraid. And I know He is a loving God, and we'll talk about that. We'll talk about Him being merciful, and we'll talk about Him being faithful. But, you know, He's not Santa Claus, and He's not Granddaddy. He's God, and He's holy, and He's just. And He said, if you go into land to possess land, you need to wipe out any influence of sin from the land. He's great and terrible. Terrifying. All right, other questions? Well, yeah, God does. God chose us. Ephesians 1, verse 3. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who chose us before the foundation of the world. You know, yeah, I mean, God chooses. And we get to choose God. He does. We have the privilege of choosing Him as well. And everything else works out in the details, which I don't know because I ain't God. Other questions? Steve. You're talking about when I'm at work and I do something that is dishonoring to God. Is that taking God's name? It could be, Steve. Yeah. I think there are probably other passages that would help us with that more. But certainly that could be one of the implications from that commandment. Other questions? 7:37. I think I did pretty good. Get all through 8. Didn't do much with chapter 7. Yes, ma'am.
It's not a question, it's a statement. But for a better understanding of the fear of the Lord, just read through the Proverbs and several verses. It gives a lot of indications for it, too. The fear of the Lord is clean, the fear of the Lord is hatred of evil. There's just tons of material there.
Yeah, the fear of the Lord. Probably a little bit different than the fear of the Lord that Moses was talking about, okay. Theologically. It's from a theology, study of God type perspective. But in that one, the fear of the Lord is probably more synonymous with obey the Lord.